Well, good evening. It's great to be back here in Salem, particularly here at Market Street. I think this is the third time we've had an opportunity to speak to you. Last time, you'll recall, I think it was January 3rd, it started snowing on us first thing in the morning. So the elders are like, hey, give us the synopsis of your sermon. I think I 15 minutes, record sermon for me. So it's good to be back with you, and I don't feel like I'm rushed tonight. I can get through the whole lesson, and Richard's not over here, you know, pointing at the watch. So thank you for your warmth and hospitality, and I look forward to studying with you tonight. Steve mentioned how we used to work together at Federal Way up in Washington, where we were the West Campus Church of Christ. And about this time last year, that group bought a new building in Tacoma. It is now known as the East Tacoma Church of Christ. I believe last week Paul Hawthorne was here and spoke for you. Paul is who has mentored both Steve and myself. And as Steve noted, we're going to be leaving Tacoma, and we've been offered an opportunity to work full-time with the North Seattle congregation up by the UW. Richard Radke's been there, I think it's like 47, 48 years or something like that, and he's peaked up into his mid-70s now, and he decides that, you know, it's a good time to let a younger guy come in and take over the work. So Kim and I have kind of been wearing dual hats. We're part-time at Tacoma and part-time in Seattle, but Steve may have mentioned in a recent sermon about my situation with my secular job. So we've sped up our timeline a little bit, and it looks like we'll be working full-time with the North Seattle group sooner than later. So anyway, it's just a pleasure to be with you. You guys have become one of my favorite congregations, and I always look forward to the opportunity to come down here because it gives us a reason to be on vacation and hang out with the Finleys. So your summer series is called My Favorite Chapter in the Bible. So before we get into my particular favorite chapter of the Bible, I want to tell you what we did today. If you don't follow Steve on Facebook, myself and BJ Sipe and Steve and Mason, we went out to, see if I can say this right, Chemeketa Community College, and we were out there, obviously I butchered it, you're all laughing, but you know what I'm talking about. And we went out there today, and the South congregation bought a case of Bibles. And we took BJ's card and Steve's card, and we taped them on the inside, and we went out and handed out Bibles today. And I was really curious to see how this was going to go today, and I kept kind of a scorecard. And we had 17 people accepted Bibles from us today, and 15 people politely said no thank you. But of the 17 people that we talked to today and gave Bibles to, we had about four or five really good conversations, people actually expressing ardent interest and asking questions, where are you guys at? And so we're hoping that'll bear some fruit. And I think Steve and BJ plan on doing this on a regular thing. But that was our day today, and it was a lot of fun, and it was a good prelude into worshiping with you tonight. Let's go ahead and get into our sermon. And I want to start in 1 John chapter 5, verse 4. John writes this, he says, "For whatever is born of God overcomes the world. And this is the victory that has overcome the world, that is our faith." Our faith, meaning our belief that Jesus is the Christ, that is our victory. Well, before we can talk about faith, we have to define what faith is. The faith comes from this Greek word shema, which literally means to trust in God or to have a sense of creed or moral conviction. Of course, the Hebrew writer defines faith for us perfectly in Hebrews 11, verse 1. The Hebrew writer says, "Faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen." You ever think about faith and realize that we are putting our trust, hope, and absolute belief in a God that we can't see? That is faith. Of course, this is the only time that the New Testament talks about faith. In Ephesians 6, you see Paul encouraging the Ephesians, saying, look, there's going to be spiritual difficulty ahead. And so Paul tells the Ephesians to put on their imaginary armor, so to speak. You know, it's an analogy. And he tells them to get ready for spiritual difficulties. And one of those pieces of body armor is what? It's our shield of faith, which helps us defend ourselves against the flaming missiles of Satan. Of course, if we go back to Hebrews 11, we see God's roll call or honor roll of the faithful. You look at the names here listed here in Hebrews 11. You got, here's Abraham. Abraham is asked by God to slay Isaac. What an emotional deal that must have been for Abraham. But, and Abraham's willing to follow through it right up to the point of raising the knife. And so he's counted as faithful. Here's Joseph sold into slavery by his brothers. And when it comes time, he meets up with his brothers again later in life. He says, it's okay. It was all part of God's plan. Joseph was counted as faithful. Here's Rahab, the harlot, who helps Joshua's spies leading up to the Battle of Jericho. And we don't know how she ever became a harlot, but we do know this, that the rest of the story, she ends up in the genealogy of Jesus Christ. And so you go on down through the list there in Hebrews 11. There's a lot of faithful souls there, right? But it's not an exhaustive list. I think about other faithful people who aren't listed there in Hebrews 11. I think of Hannah, right? And here's Samuel's mother who begged and pleaded with God to have a child. She makes a deal with God and says, look, if I can have a child, I'll dedicate him to your service. I think about Anna, the prophetess, in Luke 2:36-38. Here's Joseph and Mary bringing Jesus to present him in the temple. And what do they tell us about Anna? That she never left the temple. She served day and night with prayers and fasting. And that leads me to my favorite chapter of the Bible. I got to thinking about, okay, well, what is my favorite chapter of the Bible? And then why so? Why is that my favorite chapter? I think when you study the Bible, you have to find something that resonates with you. Something that's very deeply personal, that you're reading the Bible, you know what? I can really relate to this person. And so for me, and if you'd like to open your Bibles to Mark chapter 5, that's where we're going to spend the rest of our time this evening. In Mark chapter 5, the second half of the chapter, we meet two people there who I think are wonderful, faithful people. Those two people are a synagogue official named Jairus, and then we meet a woman who has referred to by no other name other than by her medical condition, in that she has been hemorrhaging for a long period of time. Well, those are the two people we're going to spend the rest of our time looking at tonight. Now, this story takes place in two other places. That's Matthew 9 and Luke 8 both recount this incident. I just happen to prefer Mark's account a little better, so that's where we'll be tonight, is Mark chapter 5, verse 20 through the end. Well, to set the scene, in the first half of Mark chapter 5, we see that Jesus is going to be over here in the Gerasene territory, over here kind of the northeast corner of the Sea of Galilee. And what Jesus does there is he heals a demonic. And so you see verses 1 through 19 tell us that story. Jesus heals this guy. He's mad and living amongst the tombstones of the graveyard, and Jesus heals him. Now, after Jesus heals this man, Jesus is going to go back up here to Capernaum, up here to the northwest corner of the Sea of Galilee. So when we pick up the story in Mark 5, verse 20, that's where we're at, is here in Capernaum. Okay. So chapter 5, verse 20 tells us this. It says, verse 21. It says, Jesus had crossed over again in a boat to the other side, where a large crowd had gathered around him, and so he stayed by the seashore. The first thing I want to point out is that there's a large crowd around Jesus. Now, if you follow Christ's ministry, you know that there's large crowds that follow Jesus everywhere he goes. Everywhere Christ goes, there's a throng of people. I don't know how many people were following Jesus, but let's just say that there's 1,000 or more people at any one time following Jesus. And when they see Jesus, they press in close around him. Probably the best worldly analogy I can come up with is that when I was a little boy, apparently Elvis was in Seattle. Somebody's nodding their head. My mother was a huge Elvis fan. And my mom went to great lengths to try and see Elvis when he was here in Seattle. But she wasn't the only one. You know, I mean, you think about the Beatles early on in their early years and Elvis and acts like that. You know, there were throngs of people that followed them wherever they went. Jesus, wherever he went, had a lot of followers. That's pretty amazing, don't you think? I mean, we live in a digital age. I pull out my phone here and I can, my youngest daughter's in Hawaii right now on vacation, and I can text with her. I can use Snapchat, and I can send her videos. I can FaceTime with her. We have all this technology. We've got Facebook and Instagram and all these forms of communication. You have CNN. You've got Fox and ABC and CBS and how many other news channels out there? Jesus didn't live in a culture that had that type of technology, so everything was word of mouth. Now, don't you find it impressive that enough people were talking about Jesus and his miracles that wherever he went, there were legions of followers following him around? So I want you to think about that. Word of mouth, people are talking about Jesus Christ. And so here comes this synagogue official. Verse 22 tells us, one of the synagogue officials named Jairus came up and seen him, that is Jesus, fell at his feet. Now, if you're familiar with Luke chapter 4, where Jesus begins his public ministry, you'll see that Jesus had an interaction with a synagogue official. I think they called him an attendant. Well, this guy is a synagogue official. So most scholars seem to think that by being an official, he would have been appointed by the elders to look after the buildings and the contents and the actual arrangement of worship and all this kind of thing. So here is a synagogue official. Now, was Jesus popular with the Jewish leadership? No. And we know that Annas and Caiaphas were as crooked as any politicians we have today. They hated Jesus because if he was in fact the Christ, they were going to have to change the manner in which they conducted their business. Well, your sacrifice isn't good enough, so let's take yours and sell you this one. And then I'm going to take this one and sell it to you. And they were just making money hand over fist. They were taking advantage of people and manipulating people and stepping on each other. So this guy likely was not a fan of Jesus Christ. But why does he throw himself at Jesus' feet? It says, and he entreated him earnestly, saying, my daughter is at the point of death. Please come lay your hands on her that she might get well and live. Well, that's pretty interesting, don't you think? By entreating Jesus Christ, you have the idea that he was anxiously or zealously asking Christ to do something for him. Not only that, this man, who's probably not a fan of Christ, comes up and he falls at Jesus' feet. Now, that could be a show of respect, but I tell you, as a parent, and where this gets personal for me, is he was probably desperate. You ever had a situation in your family where you'd be willing to do, you'd lay down in traffic if it meant resolving the situation? I've had two times in my life when I've been truly terrified. Both of them involved two of my three daughters. This first one here is not my best father of the moment year. My youngest daughter, she's just turned 18. She was like 3 or 4 at the time, but what had happened, Steve said I used to be a policeman, so I was working graveyard, and I was supposed to go to a school function at my older two daughters' elementary school, Valentine's Day or something like that. And so what had happened was I get up, take a shower, go out, grab a quick bite to eat, go out to my truck, and run up to the school and park and go inside. And I get inside, and my daughter's mom says, hey, where's Miranda? And some of you are like, what? Yeah. I said, well, isn't she with you? Well, no, she's at home with you. I said, well, I didn't know. I just got up from sleeping and went, you know, I came up to the school. So what does Dad do? Dad goes I go sprint out to my truck and race back home to the house. And it's fine up to the point when I reach the house. Now, my front doors faced the street, which ran north and south this way. And I get pulled into the driveway, and my front door is open. Then I start to get worried. Okay, did she, like, look outside and realize Dad's truck is gone and forget to close the door? Or did she see Dad's truck is gone and, like, leave the house? Or, you know, what's going on? I don't see her anywhere. I look up and down the street, and I can't see her. She's nowhere. I asked the neighbors who were outside, I go, have you seen my little girl? No, we haven't seen anybody. So, you know, I go in the house and I look for her and she's nowhere to be found. And I have to tell you, I mean, when I tell this story, I literally relive it emotionally because my knees buckled and I was sick to my stomach. I was like, okay, she's not in the house. She's not outside. I don't see her in any direction. I've only been gone maybe 20 minutes at the most. Okay, somebody has snatched my kid. That's my first thought. So I run over to the police department, which is where I worked, and I said, hey, you know, has anybody seen my daughter? Anybody called about a missing kid or anything like that? And no, we haven't heard anything. About 10 minutes goes by, longest 10 minutes of my life. And my chief, who lived about a quarter of a mile away, calls me up and he goes, hey, I've got your kid here. Okay, great. Now, I know she's safe, but what does Dad do anyway? That's right, I drive like a madman to get there. And so I go zipping up the driveway, and I get out of my truck, and I go run up to the front door, and here's Miranda. And you have to imagine she's wearing this, like, puffy jean jacket, and you got little pigtails on either side. And she'd been crying, and she stands there, you know, trying to be as strong as she can with a quivering bottom lip, and she goes, Daddy, I looked both ways before I crossed the street. I tell you what, for about 10 minutes there, I literally thought somebody had snatched her and that she was gone. The reason I share that with you, and maybe you've had situations with your children, this guy's desperate. My daughter is dying. Please, Jesus, do something. And he's so desperate, he falls down at Jesus' feet. Please, just come to my house and heal my daughter. So verse 24 tells us Jesus began to go to the synagogue official's house. Great, right? Jesus is going to heal the little girl? Except that there's an interruption that takes place. See, now we're introduced to another character in the story. And it tells us in verse 25, a woman who had had a hemorrhage for 12 years had endured much at the hands of many physicians, spent all that she had had, was not helped at all, but rather had gotten worse. Well, what does she do? Well, first, ladies, let me just say, I can't wrap my mind around having that type of condition for a week, 2 weeks, a month, 2 months. This woman had been sick for 12 years. I can't fathom that. And I know people who struggle with having, like, low iron levels and things like that. And, you know, they're lethargic and sometimes it's hard to get the motor going. 12 years this woman suffered. And she's going to enter the scene now. Before we get to her, one of the commentators, Adam Clark, he's one of the scholars I tend to look at. He says this of her condition. He says, because of the nature of her condition, she could not have gone out in public without being shamed, because she would have been considered dirty. Lasting 12 years, we don't get any indication whatsoever that it was kind of sporadic or here and there or in intervals. The Bible tells us it was 12 continual years. There's no other reason to think otherwise. I don't care if it's a headache, a sprained toe, or sprained eyebrow, for that matter. If you've got something that lasts 12 years, I tell you what, that's got to be tremendously difficult. Her disorder is aggravated by the medicines and treatment she receives. Remember, we're told that she had grown worse. Her malady is both ruinous to her health and circumstances. So if she's considered dirty, it's probably hard for her to make ends meet to begin with. And whatever money she does have, she's spending on quacks who can't make her better. She's broke. Anybody know people with cancer who, maybe insurance doesn't cover all the treatment, so they incur these like massive financial bills? We have some friends back home, Karen Bartle. She's recovering from leukemia. And her treatments were like $100,000 a session or something like that. I mean, just some outrageous figures. We have another brother who's a preacher in Sumner, Washington, where my dad was an elder. Jeff's going through chemo for like the third time. And these treatments are just outrageously expensive. She has spent every dime she's got trying to get well. She's broke. She's got nothing left. Clark goes on to say this about her action, that she was brought to her last point of wretchedness and want and despair. She's getting worse. She doesn't have any money, and she doesn't know what else to do. You want to know what treatments she may have possibly endured to get better or worse? According to rabbinical law, this would have been the cure for her condition. The first one is to take gum of Alexandria, alum of Crocus horrendus, or whatever that is, and put it all together, I guess, and you give it to her to drink. And that's supposed to cure the problem. But that's just the first step. If the second step doesn't work, then what you do is you take Persian onion 9 logs and you boil them in wine and you give that to her to drink. That's supposed to cure the problem. If that doesn't work, you'll like the third one. This is my favorite one. What you do is a person that has this condition is you, I guess you put them somewhere, I don't know, maybe out in the woods or something like that, and then you come up and you go, boo, and you're supposed to startle them, and startling them apparently is supposed to stop the blood flow. These are the types of things she may have been subjected to that she's now broke. Let's go back to the story. It says in verse 27, after hearing about Jesus, now mind you, she didn't turn on the news, she didn't go to Facebook, Instagram, or anything else. She has heard about Jesus Christ and the miracles that he performs. And she says, if I can just touch the edge of his garment, maybe I'll get better. Now think about this. This is how desperate she is. She doesn't say, well, I wonder if I bump against him in the crowd, maybe that'll make me better. Or maybe if I run up and give him a hug, maybe that'll make me better. She says, look, if I just touch the edge of his clothes, maybe that will heal me. This woman is desperate. She's willing to do anything. So, she does just that. She reaches out, she touches Jesus' garment. Verse 29 tells us, immediately, the flow of her blood dried up and she felt in her body that she was healed of her affliction. Wow. She could feel it. She could feel that she had instantly gotten better. Verses 30, 31, 32 are kind of interesting because Jesus, I think, is kind of feigning here, right? There's all these people around and he says, who touched me? What do the disciples respond? Like, and I'm paraphrasing, are you kidding? Look at all the people around you and you're asking us who touched you? Jesus knew who touched him. She now knows that Jesus knows that somebody touched him. He probably felt the power leave him. Verse 33 says, but the woman, fearing and trembling, aware of what had happened to her, she could feel it, came and she fell down before Jesus. She falls down before Jesus to show reverence and respect for who he was. She believed he was the Christ. She now knows that to be fact because she's been sick for 12 years and now all of a sudden is better. And so she tells him the whole truth. She tells him everything. And I don't know how long this takes for this to happen. You know, Jesus is a loving, compassionate Lord. And I don't imagine this was a 30-second exchange of, well, I've been sick for a while, and I thought, I'd see if you could help me. I wonder if there's not a few minutes of exchange there where Jesus shows express interest in her and wants to know her story. That's how I think of it. Jesus says to her, now she's told him everything, maybe, 5 minutes of telling him her life story. And he says, daughter, your faith has made you well.
What made her well? Is it Jesus' physical ability to heal her? That's kind of the given, right? But Jesus tells her that her faith in him, that he's the Son of the living God, that's what made her better. And so what does he tell her? Very gently and lovingly, he says, go in peace and be healed of your affliction. You can only imagine what maybe her life was like after this point. You know, maybe she's financially able to take care of herself, and just everything turns around for her, is my guess. And Jesus tells her, go be well. Go in peace. Now, the father in me, as I studied this story, is screaming, going, wait a sec. I was here first, and my kid is dying. And this woman's come and interrupted us. Remember, verse 24 told us that Jesus began to go to Jairus' house, right? But now he's been held up for, I don't know, let's say just 5 minutes. For 5 minutes he's been distracted. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us. I'm just saying, if it were me, I'd be like, excuse me, over here. The reason I say that is because I feel for this dad. Because for the first time in my life, I was truly, truly terrified. It had to do with my middle daughter, Hannah. She's 20 now. You know, you moms and grandmas know that so kids, when they're born, get booster shots, and then on their birthday, they get more booster shots, right? So here, Hannah had her one-year birthday checkup shots, like MMRP, mumps, measles, rubella, chickenpox, whatever it is. And so she developed a fever, and it's common for kids to develop a fever after receiving these shots. And so over the course of the afternoon, Hannah's fever had gotten a little worse and a little worse, and so called the doctor. The doctor says, give the kid Benadryl, she'll be fine. And so what happens, we get into early evening, and when little kids have a high fever, they flinch. And Hannah would flinch, you know, every 10 minutes, you know, every 20 minutes, something like that. And sometimes she'd flinch really hard. It would startle her, and she'd cry. You know, breaks your heart, so you console the kid, and, you know, you try to comfort them. And this went on throughout the night. So come bedtime, and I'll just say for, like, let's say it's 9 o'clock, and so I put Hannah in her crib. I've been a policeman 3 years. You'd think I'd have some composure about me. I put my daughter down in her crib, walked out the door, and no sooner had I closed her door, and I just heard this, I'd say blood-curdling scream, because I've never heard anything like it before or since. So I open the door, and I look in the crib, and Hannah's having a seizure. A full-on, full seizure. So I start to panic. So I scoop her up out of her crib, and I've got her in my arm, and so I call 911. And the 911 operator on the other end of the phone is she's an angel, because she put up with me. I probably wasn't very kind to her. But my daughter is turning blue. I don't see a good color blue in here, but she's not breathing. And my guess is that she went the better part of a minute without breathing while she was having this seizure. I honestly thought my little girl was going to die. So I'm on the phone with 911. I have a seizing baby in my hand. She's not breathing. She's turning color. And the 911 operator says, it's okay, sir. Somebody be there in just a minute to help you. I'm like, no, you don't understand. I need you here now. My little girl is dying. The 5 minutes it took for the firefighters from Auburn, Washington, to make it to my house and tend to my little girl, I think about it every time I talk about it, because I was scared, and I thought I was going to lose her. And maybe you have your own stories with your kids, but now can you relate to this dad? His little girl is sick, and that's all he knows. He's desperate. He's asked Christ for help, even to the point of throwing himself at the feet of the Savior, or the Master. So Jesus healed this woman. Jairus been waiting for him. Now what happens? Verse 35 tells us that while he was still speaking, so who knows, maybe Jesus was still speaking to the woman, they came from the house of the synagogue official saying, "Your daughter has died, why trouble the teacher anymore?" We're not told of any dialogue between Jairus and the Lord from this point forward. But can you imagine? You've been waiting patiently. You asked nicely. He agreed to come. He gets distracted. And while he's having a conversation with other people, somebody comes and says, "You know what? It's too late. She's gone." Was Jesus' reply? It says, Jesus overhears this. He says, "Do not be afraid any longer, only believe." What do you think Jesus means here when he tells Jairus to believe? The way I interpret it is, you came to me thinking I was the Christ, and you thought enough of me that I could heal your daughter 5 minutes ago. You need to continue to believe that I am the Christ and that I can heal her. Jesus tells them to believe. So they go to Jairus' house, and they come to the house of the synagogue official, and behold, there's a commotion of people weeping loudly and wailing. Would be natural, right? When people have a close, beloved family member that dies, it's natural to weep and mourn. I've been to, I can't even begin to tell you the number of death investigations I've been to, but I've been to enough. One that particularly stands out to me was an older gentleman, obviously the patriarch of his family, had passed away in his sleep. And so here's all the kids and the grandkids and other family members, maybe brothers or whatever. And they're all just kneeling around this person, and they're weeping and wailing, and they're devastated at the loss of this person. This is a child. How much more so is it to lose a child? I know a couple people who have lost a child. They say you can, life goes on and you learn how to deal with it, but you never really get over it. This is devastating. So much so that people are wailing. They're not just crying, they're wailing, they're mourning. So, Jesus goes in and he says to them, why make all the commotion? Why are you weeping? The child is not dead, she's just asleep. Verse 40 tells us that the people that were there, maybe other family members and such, said that they began laughing at Jesus. I don't think these people were actually mocking Jesus, like, ha, ha, ha. You know, maybe it's that nervous laughter, right? You ever done that? Laughed in an inappropriate moment? So I think that's what happens here in verse 40. But in verse 41, it says, "And taking the child by the hand, he," that is Jesus, "said to her, 'Talitha, come,' which means, 'Little girl, I say to you, arise.' And immediately the girl rose and began to walk, for she was 12 years old." What an amazing story. And there's some things that strike me about these verses, verse 20 through the end of the chapters. We meet these two really amazing people. The first one is that this synagogue official, Jairus, it's highly probable that he would have been a detractor of Jesus Christ and his teachings. The Jewish leadership were not fans of Jesus or his disciples, or John for that matter. They were constantly spying on him, trying to catch him doing wrong. The humility that both these people display, both the synagogue official and the woman. One, in their belief that he was the Christ and that he could heal them. And two, the fact that Mark tells us that both of them fell down before Jesus to show him the respect and honor he deserved. For the synagogue official, it's quite possible that going to Jesus for help may have been career threatening. And the other thing that I notice, particularly with Jairus, is that Jesus doesn't rush. The master had a plan. He knew what he was doing. Maybe he was just testing Jairus to make sure that Jairus really believed that he was the Christ and could heal his little girl. whatever the case is, Jesus doesn't go sprinting over there. He heals this woman, has a conversation with her, apparently is maybe teaching other people, and then walks over to the synagogue official's house to heal the little girl. But both had faith that Jesus was the Son of God. That's the important thing here. Thomas, in John chapter 20, verses 24 and 29, what does Thomas say? Here Jesus is risen from the dead. He's presented himself to his disciples. Here's Thomas, says, unless I see his hands and the imprint of the nails and put the my finger into the place with the nails and put my hand into his side, I will not believe that he has risen from the dead. What does Jesus have to say to Thomas? In chapter 20, verse 9, Jesus says to Thomas, you have seen me, and you haven't believed? Blessed are those who do not see, yet believe in me. We live in the modern era. God's not going to come talk to us in a burning bush. The Lord's not going to whisper to you in your ear. It's not how God communicates with us now. God gave us this. He gave us the apostles, men like Luke and Paul, who were inspired by the Holy Spirit, to give us his word. This book is God's inspired word, and without it, we wouldn't know what was holy. We wouldn't know how to worship God if it were not for our Bibles. Jesus says, blessed are those who believe in me and can't see me. I sometimes hear people say, well, you know, if I had lived back in Jesus' time, I would have believed in Jesus. I'd be the most ardent disciple ever. Really? It didn't work for Thomas. Thomas had the privilege of seeing Jesus do hundreds of miracles. And yet when it came time, Jesus is risen from the dead. Thomas says, unless I can actually touch him, your cheese has slid off the cracker. In Matthew 17, verses 19 through 20, Jesus says this, because of the littleness of your faith, truly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, why do you think the Lord chose a mustard seed? Because it's the smallest of all seeds. It's a teeny tiny little thing. So if you have faith as a mustard seed, you shall say to this mountain, move here to there, and it shall move, and nothing shall be impossible for you. What Jesus is saying, look, is even just a little bit of faith can help guide you through the rocky waters of life. And I don't know who said this. It's unattributed, but I love this quote. It says, faith can move mountains, but do not be surprised if God hands you a shovel. So we go back to the very first slide that we showed you tonight. Remember, John said in 1 John 5:4, whatever is born of God overcomes the world, and this is the victory that has overcome the world, our belief that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. That is faith, believing that Jesus was a real man, that he emptied himself of his deity, came here and lived on this world, John chapter 1, and that he was willing to go to the cross and be crucified and scourged so that you and I can have the hope of salvation, eternity in heaven with the Father. If you're here tonight and you have not been baptized for forgiveness of sin, I think Steve said that we've got some water back here. It'd be an honor to help you with that and baptize you. You could go home with a clean slate. Or perhaps you're here tonight and you go, you know what, I've been struggling with some life challenges or things. Maybe I need help with something. And I'd like the prayers of the congregation on my behalf if we could help you in any way, whether you need to be baptized or you would like the help of the congregation or prayers. Wouldn't you let us know? We're going to stand here in just a moment. Kelly's going to lead us in 576. 576, faith is the victory.